Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast for the week of November 8th. And I'm joined today by Father Raymond Schroth, who's a new editor, well, new and former editor of America. Right. Welcome, Father Ray.
Good to be back.
Now, Father Ray, you were here in the 60s and you just returned this summer.
So right.
You have a long history with the magazine. Right. Now, Father Ray has a new book out, which we're going to talk about, which is called Bob Drynan, The Controversial Life of the First Catholic Priest Elected to Congress. You know, some of our listeners may not know the whole story of Father Drynan, so this is a good time to kind of catch up on his legacy. Just died a few years ago, correct?
Right. In 2007.
Right
at the end of the year, December. Right.
December 2007. Yeah. Before we talk about his time in Congress in the 70s, maybe we can start by just, you know, a little bit of history of where he come from, where he came from, and what drew him to the Jesuits.
Well, he grew up at a place called Hyde Park, which was a middle-class town in the neighborhood of Boston, a short drive from the center of Boston town. And he first went to a Catholic grammar school, and then he went to a middle school that was a public school for a little, just a couple of years, then a public high school, and then finally to Boston College. Boston College was just about getting off the ground at that time, and so that was a very, very formative influence on his life. Then he joined the Jesuits right after graduation, and from there went through the general Jesuit course, and while toward the end, he sort of got a little more interested in public life and in writing, and particularly in America Magazine. America Magazine is one of the first places that gave him his name in print. Then went to law school and was sent right to BC as a young man, and BC Law School again was just in its early years, and very quickly he was made the dean. And he put a great emphasis on excellence. And he really wanted to move that school into the modern era. The modern era at that time was in the 1950s and 1960s. He had to make a name for himself, for the school. And toward the end of that, in his deanship, there was got a certain restlessness. He was very involved in public affairs, and he was used as a mediator for a couple of racial disputes or union disputes. He was ecumenically concerned. He got a lot of friends in the Jewish community, and his name was around. And meanwhile, the Vietnam War was at its sort of, I don't say height or worse. And the local Democratic Party, among, at least the liberals among them, wanted to get rid of their current congressman who was really supporting Nixon on the Vietnam War. And they turned to Bob, and this is really as the youth movement in politics was really coming to a head, and students were considered radicals, and there were a lot of demonstrations. So he sort of comes into, with all that going on, it was right after the Democratic Convention in Chicago, where young people protested against the war, and so he's conscious of all of this. And so he accepts their invitation to run for Congress. The first election was 1970. So he simultaneously, like 68 and 69, he's moving up in the politics of Boston College. And he was made a vice president at the same time he was thinking of running for office. And so he could have gone either way. He did hope to become the president of Boston College. But he lost that, and I think that was another incentive for him to move in another direction.
So was it a tight race in 1970, or was he?
Yes. Well, the tight race was the primary, because the district was an overwhelmingly Democratic district, and but if he had beat this other guy, who was an older man, I think he was 70, and that was considered a very old man. As Drynan kept dropping that his age into all his public speeches, and it was close, but the election was historic to the degree at which it used volunteers and a lot of the modern electionary techniques that are being used today.
So 1970, he's elected to office. Right. And, I mean, this seems so unusual today, that the idea of a priest holding public office. Back then, was it radical? I mean, was it a real surprise for people to see this happen?
Yes and no. What happened, it was at a time when priests and ministers and rabbis and religious figures were getting more and more involved in politics. And the year Drinan ran, and I think perhaps for the year the race after that, across the country there are at least a dozen priests who were trying to run for office. And so there was a nun who ran for mayor out in the Midwest, and John McLaughlin, who is known for the McLaughlin Report, was a Jesuit of the same province, but very conservative, right? He was trying to run for office, and Drinan was running. So a lot of people were doing it, but it was still a bit of a shock to parts of the population. In fact, in the polls for Drinan's first run showed there that he did not have a strong support among the Catholics in the district, because the Catholics didn't like the idea of a priest getting out of the sacristy or out of the pulpit, and they just couldn't quite work on that. Now, eventually, I'm sure he won a lot of them over, but the pollsters and the people who had asked him to run were a little shocked. They figured him running, of course, that's going to be the Catholic vote. It was just the opposite.
Right. Well, this was, we should say this was Massachusetts, so a district outside of Boston?
Yes.
Outside of
around
Boston?
Around Newton.
Around Newton.
Yeah.
The one held today by Barney Frank, correct?
Yes, that's it, right.
In fact, Frank has held the seat ever since Drinan left.
Yeah.
One phrase that comes up in your book often, and one that Father Drinan used himself, was moral architect.
Right.
What did he mean by that?
Well, it was his self-image. I'd say in the practical realm, he saw himself as a moral leader. That's he knew more about what was right and wrong than other people did, so therefore he could build a structure for the community that a lot of the moral elements in it. Now, his concentration was on social justice, peace and social justice. He was not a pacifist, but he was a very strong critic of war and a good analyst of just war theory. And he would apply that very strictly to a war situation when it would begin to emerge. But it would also be human rights. He had a great care for refugees. I think if he had stayed in Congress today, he would be a leader in the discussion of what do we do about immigration. He was particularly concerned about Latin America and the South Pacific. He made a number of big trips there in his last couple of years.
Well, let's return to Vietnam. Maybe we can focus on that for a second. Obviously, this was a real charged topic at the time. What did he do, you know, as a freshman congressman, to bring this issue, into the realm of political debate?
A good thing to keep in mind is that even before he ran for Congress, he had been to Vietnam with an ecumenical group, a couple of Protestants and a Quaker and a Jewish leader, and so they'd been to Saigon, and they talked with the Vietnamese leaders, and he made a point of visiting prisoners, the people whom the South Vietnam government had put in prison for speaking out in criticism of their own government. And so he was very conscious of that and was quite willing to criticize our allies. I think today it'd be analogous to criticizing Karzai or Maliki or someone like that whom we put in office. So he had been there during the war and was very upset about the injustices that he saw. When he came home, he made a point of visiting Washington offices and getting into the State Department to try to make a couple of his points, and he would get very frustrated when he wasn't listened to. So he was already revved up on Vietnam. Now, insofar as what is his impact as a legislator, it's limited. And he himself, although he was constantly proposing bills and backing other people's bills, there were only a few big bills in Congress that have been named after him, and most of those had something to do with labor legislation. But the more he would advocate, speak out, go around telling people, trying to teach about the immorality of the war and attend protests, that was his impact. And that was closely associated with the impeachment. So he was the first person to call for the impeachment of Nixon, but he did it first because he was a year before the Congressional Judiciary Committee got around to it, of which he was a member.
Okay, yeah. So this was around the time of Watergate.
Yeah.
He was one of the first that came out and called for the impeachment.
But not because of Watergate.
Okay.
So the issue that pushed him in, pushed Nixon out, was Watergate. But for Drynan, it was the bombing of Cambodia, which was illegal, unauthorized, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It had been reported by, I think it was Seymour Hersh in the New York Times or someone like that, someone that level. So it wasn't as if nobody knew it was happening, but it was neglected. It's as if it hadn't happened, even though it had been in the papers. And Nixon just presumed that he had a right to do it because he was the president.
So when the actual impeachment for the Watergate hearings came around, was Drynan involved with those?
It was his committee.
Okay.
So the committee which determines whether or not to, you can't use the word indictment because it's not, impeachment is not a legal proceeding in the usual sense of that. It's a political discussion to decide whether or not the president is not, he doesn't have to break any laws. He can have a pattern of irresponsible behavior that could have him removed from office. So Drynan was very conscious of that. He still insisted that one of the impeachment motions, the sort of the bill of indictments, one of the several indictments, would have to be on the bombing of Cambodia. But the rest of the House Judiciary Committee rejected that.
Okay, so that was never included.
Right.
Was he considered, I mean, on this particular issue, a voice because he was a priest? Did the other legislators see him as having some kind of moral standing that perhaps other legislators did not?
I'd say yes and no. Those who were his strongest critics from the anti-abortion movement blamed him for giving legitimacy to abortion, because they said that they would speak to certain congressmen, they could be Catholic or religious congressmen, and the congressman would say something, well, Father Drynan thinks it's all right. Drynan feels that in a multicultural, pluralistic society, you cannot legislate a morality that's specific to one religious group. And he was seen by his enemies as giving a green light to what they saw as an immoral procedure and immoral policy.
So just to be clear, he was personally and theologically pro-life, but legally he was pro-choice.
That's exactly where he would put it. It's a sin, not a crime.
It's a sin, not a crime. Okay. Yeah. And this, maybe we can transition to, you know, the last years of his time in office, the stand he took specifically on funding, for public funding for abortions, that really were among the things that forced him out of office. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah.
So what was it? Did that drew his superiors' attention, the Pope's attention?
Well, it was cumulative. There were two issues that sort of bugged him all the way through his career. The first was, did he have permission to run for office? Right? And we could talk for half an hour on that, but we won't. Right? And to make a long story short, he had it. He had permission in the sense that it was tolerated by the Jesuit superiors. Ecclesiastical superiors didn't want to make an issue of it where it looked like they were going against the Society of Jesus. So they didn't like it. Religious superiors in Rome didn't like it. His religious superiors in the New England province did like it. And they carried the day by convincing Father Arupe to back off. So, but this would come up every 2 years, and there'd always be a reinterpretation and a re-arguing of the whole thing, and with his critics charging that he did not have permission.
So it was 1980 that eventually, that's when he was ultimately forced to leave.
Yeah.
And that came from Rome?
That came from Rome. That came from the Pope. I wasn't in the room, but it was probably something like the Pope calls Ratzinger, or Ratzinger calls Father Arupe, or the Pope calls Arupe, or something like that. And Arupe calls the provincial of New England, or Arupe's assistant calls him, and then he tells Drynan.
So this was Pope John Paul II, who obviously took a very different stand on the place of priests and religious in public life.
Right. Because he was also fighting against the influence of religious priests in Latin America who were accepting government jobs in Nicaragua.
So this was a time when, the order came down to Drynan that he could not run. What was the argument he was making? Why did he think he should stay?
Well, he wrote eloquently to the general, and he'd write a letter like this almost every 2 years when he would be told to drop out and say, well, he would tell Rome that he's a moral architect. And then he would try to give evidence that he was showing leadership in the Catholic and in the religious community. And he'd say, I just got an award from the Jewish establishment, or I just got an honorary doctorate from Santa Clara, or I just got an honorary doctorate from Notre Dame. And so Catholics are looking up to me. I support the position of the American bishop against the draft. And so he would sort of make a list of all these social justice positions which the American bishops took and show that he worked assiduously in Washington to have these things made into law.
And as your book says, he also invokes Matteo Ricci. I mean, he shows that as he believed he was in kind of carrying on the legacy there. But obviously this was a change. This was a time post Roe versus Wade where abortion politics were taking a greater presence in American politics.
Yeah.
And that seems to be really what kind of forced Rome's hand.
Yeah.
Okay, so post-1980, you hinted at this before. What do you think if he stayed in Congress? What are some of the things that he could have accomplished?
I think the one thing that's been mentioned to me the most often, and not a fair good number of times, is immigration and refugees. That's something we're nowhere near resolving right now, and he would have used whatever religious qualities, whatever political qualities he had to combine his religion and his political skills with that. He is not, as far as I can tell, a political leader among the other politicians in Congress. I think they respected him. Some probably thought he was a bit eccentric and were not enthusiastic about the Roman collar, and others were.
Yeah, just to be clear, he wore the Roman collar every day in the Capitol.
Yeah.
Now, you bring up the name Robert Drynan. Even today, there's still the controversy over the abortion question.
Yeah.
Later on in life, he published an op-ed, which you note in your book, on the New York Times about partial birth abortion, which drew a lot of criticism. Do you have a sense that he had any kind of second thoughts on this, or he stayed pretty true to his original beliefs?
Well, he published a lot of books. Every several years, he'd come out with another book, and one was... most of them were collections of talks and other things that he had written or his columns. And in one, I quoted, I think it came out in the 90s about politics along the Potomac. And there's a chapter on abortion. And he expresses a hope in there for the time when people would come to see what a terrible thing this is.
Well, obviously, this is a very complicated issue, and your book unpacks a lot of it, so I'd recommend that to our readers. Mm-hmm. And of course, we'll put a link up to it on our podcast. But I just want to end with, as you said, when he was elected in office, there were, a dozen priests and religious running for office around the country. Now, that's unheard of in this country.
Yeah.
Maybe in some other countries it may happen. We saw it happen in Haiti, some Latin American countries. Is the era of the priest politician over? Do you ever see a time when things might change?
I don't. And one of the more illuminating moments I had in writing this book was when I was speaking to the man, who was a Jewish man, Mr. Grossman, who was one of the people who first selected Bob to run for office. there, no Mr. Grossman, Jerome Grossman, no Dryden, really, historically. I said, what is your feeling about priests running for office? And he said, I'm against it, except for one.
So Bob Dryden was a unique personality, unique figure who could pull this off, but it's not something that many people could do.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the book again is Bob Dryden. Father Ray Schroth, this is Fordham University Press and comes out November 2010. So we congratulate you and recommend the book to our readers.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
We want to thank you for joining us for the American Magazine podcast and recommend you look online this week where we have video testimony from soldiers who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that comes from the Truth Commission on Conscience in War. We also have a couple of interviews coming up worth noting. One is with the Jesuit priest Mark Massa talking about his book, The American Catholic Revolution. We also have an interview with Morgan Atkinson, a film producer who has done a documentary on the writer John Howard Griffith. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.